What we're trying to do this week is to go through the unfolding covenant in the Old Testament so that when you see certain passages in the Old Testament, you'll say, oh, that reminds me of something Wolf said, or this means this because of what we've had. Now, we're going to spend the covenant in the ancient Near East today, which is a lot of archaeology, but it isn't only archaeology. You'll get some religion. Then Israel as God's people, then the king as Yahweh's people, and then the prophet at the trial of the covenant breakers, and then hope and renewal in the covenant. We'll be dealing with everything here. We'll be dealing primarily here with the book of Deuteronomy. We'll be dealing here frequently with the Psalms and with the Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles. Here we'll be dealing with Isaiah and Micah and Amos and a great many of the prophets. Here we'll be dealing with Jeremiah and the New Testament, so that we'll be cutting a little bit. Now, obviously, interest in this word covenant is rather ancient. That's why we have the Old Testament and the New Testament. We really ought to call them testaments, because in our present-day English, the word testament usually is something that comes to someone after another person's died, or it's a testator who has left something of interest to us. Maybe we'd be much happier if we talk about the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. These are the terms that would be clear. Now, in modern times, within the last 20 years or so, people have again tried to emphasize covenant. Walter Eichroth, who is a German theologian, said that the whole of the Old Testament could be understood on the basis of covenant, that it unified the entire concept of the Hebrew Bible. Then in 1944, a man by the name of Bergreich suggested that the covenants in the Old Testament were unilateral. You've heard this word frequently because of the protestations that some of the people in Washington make against pacifists. Our pacifists frequently say that we should make a unilateral treaty or a unilateral disarmament pact, that we will do it on our own side. We'll sign it, regardless of how anybody else responds, regardless of what happens. That this unilateral was there rather than bilateral or mutual or reciprocal. Now, all of this is out of date. And that's why, having said these few things, we want to come to year 1955, when an LCA pastor who teaches at the University of Michigan first began to think in these terms on the basis of ancient covenant forms that we're going to look at. The book you can buy over in the bookstore if you're interested in it, it's George Mendenhall's little red pamphlet here, which is a reprint of an article he wrote in the Biblical Archaeologist. This reprint is called Law and Covenant in Israel and the Ancient Near East. This is a pioneer study of 1955. Therefore, in the last 10 years, most of what you're going to hear is new. Some of this had been suggested earlier, but it's a new way of looking at the Bible. Now let's go back to the Old Testament itself. There is a Hebrew word called berith. B-E-R-I-T-H, which is used about 280-some times in the Old Testament Hebrew. What it means, we're not quite sure until we see it in context. There is an Assyrian word, and the root means to fetter or to bind. And this would be all right if you wanted to use it. But in its context, berith has these verbs with it. You cut a covenant. You make a covenant, or in sometimes you enter in to a covenant. A great king gives a covenant or issues a covenant. So that many people say that probably the word ought to be translated treaty. That it's closer to what we have as a treaty. You make a treaty, you enter into a treaty with Russia, we give and they give, or somebody issues a covenant. Now, almost always, in connection with these ancient covenants, there was a meal, there was a sacrifice, there were probably oaths, so that the distinction that we make between a religious covenant and a legal or an economic or a business or political treaty can't be made. Because this, we might say, is physical or
profane, and this we would say is spiritual, and this we get into the legal, or where that is, I don't know. Only Dr. Rieke can tell us whether this is profane or whether this is legal or whether it's spiritual today. But you put these three together, you really have a feeling of the whole. Now, in the covenant, underneath that, there's another word that's frequently used in the Old Testament, eduth, E-D-U-T-H. And this word actually refers to just part of the covenant. It's the translated in the Bible, testimonies. The testimonies of the Lord are sure, enduring forever. You've heard that phrase so often in the Bible. Probably eduth is equal to covenant, so that the major part of something stands for the whole. This eduth is a section in these ancient Near Eastern covenants that we're going to look at in a moment. Now, in the Greek New Testament, this word berith is translated diatheke, and it's from this that we get our word covenant, because the Greek, like our word testament, goes either way. It can mean a treaty or it can mean a testament. Diatheke is always used in the Old Testament Greek and the New Testament. This is the Greek word for this Hebrew. So that our idea, 270 times, diatheke is used for the 286 occurrences in Hebrew. That's pretty consistent. So that we get this concept. Now, if this is true, 286 times, 270 times, and in many other places in the Bible, then this ought to be an important concept. Reading from one scholar, I'll give you this sentence. The covenant has been retained as the central concept by which to illuminate the structural unity and the unchanging basic tendency of a message of the Old Testament. For it is in this concept that Israel's fundamental conviction of its special relationship with God is concentrated. Now, Mendenhall's addition to all of this is that there are certain archaeologically discovered treaties and covenants which shed light on what we're trying to talk about. There are, for example, Sumerian, Hittite, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Egyptian treaties, which we would call international treaties. These treaties talk about the kinds of relationship that God had with his people. They also talk about the kinds of curses that the prophets spoke to their prophets. The prophets spoke to the people. This is the way we have it. So, the central form of Israelites' religion was the belief that there had been a covenant between Yahweh and Israel. A covenant between these, a treaty, as if it were a treaty by a Hittite king to a little Palestinian king. Or as if President Johnson had made a treaty with some little African country. Now, these are not unilateral. They are not mutual. When the United States says we make a mutual defense pact with Cambodia, this is nonsense. I mean, this is only for public consumption that it's unilateral. We don't expect little Cambodia to come to our defense when Russia lands in New York. I mean, this is silly. It's actually something altogether different than a unilateral or even mutual contract. Now, these covenants are rather interesting because you not only find them in what we call the profane world, in the Bible, you also find them, as I've said, in the sacred world. A couple of the profane ones you find in the Bible are the covenants between Jacob and Laban, the covenant between David and Jonathan, the covenant between Isaac and Abimelech, the covenant between Joshua and the Gibeonites. And then that took another form later. Now, put two types of covenants down here, and a third, just for fun. Two of them are archaeologically attested. This is the one I've just been talking about. Many people thought the Old Testament was a parity, a mutual, a reciprocal treaty, so that you would have Jacob and Laban. That's reciprocal. Or David and John. Or Joshua and the Gibeonites at the beginning, when they treat each other as equals mutually. Or if you take it outside of the Bible, it would be between Egyptians and Babylonians when they were both great powers fighting for the middle road there, and they had a status quo arrangement. There is another window, however, that occurs, vassalage treaty. And this is quite frequent, a vassalage treaty. Now, Joshua and the Gibeonites, after Joshua discovered that they had tricked him, belongs here. Remember, they say we will be hewers of wood and drawers of water. That doesn't sound like a very mutual agreement. It sounds as if they had been put down a little bit. You have some other suggestions here. You have the vassalage which comes between father and son. We normally don't think of that. In fact, maybe we should think about it more. We too often have our children and our parent relationship up at number one, a parity treaty. You know, our children need pals, they say. No, they don't. They've got enough pals and enough peers. They need a father, or they need somebody above them. Same thing true, most of the women don't like this, but this is also where marriage belongs. In the Old Testament, marriage is down there. Some of you women won't like it particularly. You'd much rather have it equal, or maybe you'd rather have vassalage as long as the husband has the hook in his nose. This is all right, if you want to look at it that way, but marriage is this kind of a thing. Now, in the vassalage treaty, you have a couple of political ones in the Old Testament. Remember when Babylon had conquered northern Israel and southern Judah gets a little bit scary? They start paying tribute off, to buy the boys off. That's vassalage. Not this. Little old Judah couldn't stand up against Assyria or Babylon. They were down here. So Ezekiel talks about this. That this is the way you were. You were the one who was small. Or in Job, you have a system that's somewhat like this, in which God says to Job, have you made a covenant with the whales? The answer obviously is no. Only God can be even considered partially on a parity level, an equal level, with whales. Job can't make a covenant with the whale or with Leviathan. This is impossible. Now, these two are archaeologically affirmed. We find them in archaeology. We'll talk about the dates of them in a moment. There's one more that's in the Bible. And this is a difficult one. And this is the problem that faces us through these first four points. And it also bothers us in the New Testament. The third type of covenant is the promissory covenant. It's a binding oath for the future in which one person has taken all the obligations and there are no reciprocal obligations imposed on the other. So this is eternal, usually, by oath, and it is binding on the superior one. Now this is a tricky one. Watch this. Here, the binding, the stipulations are on both. Here, there might be bindings on both, but most of them are bound on the vassal, the inferior. Here, it's on the superior. Now this is the thing that the Davidic dynasty relied on. It's also the promise that was given to Abraham. You know, you shall be great, you shall inherit the people, and you shall bless all the nations. Not one word said about what Abraham's got to do. It's just an out-and-out promise. Or Nathan gives it to David. My spirit will not depart from your house as it did from the house of Saul, but I will make you an everlasting covenant. Doesn't say one word to what David or David's dynasty has to do. It's an out-and-out promissory covenant. We've never found one of these in archaeology yet. The other two forms we have in archaeology, this one, in the present state of our knowledge, we don't. Yes?
The first word, by oath.
Eternal, by oath. It's an eternal or everlasting covenant, that phrase. Now, we won't get to this today, but just to let you know where we're coming. You see, part of the problem is that Israel, as God's people, comes under number two over there, the vassalage covenant. The king, as Yahweh's vassal, also comes under two, properly understood. But the nationalistic, Pharisaical point of view turned this one into number three. As if David's dynasty has it just because God said it, regardless of what they did. And so you get the struggle between Amos and Hosea. Can God have another king than a dynastic king after David? Or Hosea, who says, of course he can. He's going to be so eternally loyal and everlastingly favorable toward David that no matter what they do, he's still their God. So the prophet then gets into the middle of it. The prophet has to see whether it's really a promissory or whether it is a vassalage treaty. And can it be completely destroyed or is there only renewal? Now, there are never any theological treaties of this type. God is never equal to man. Theological treaties are all down here or here. Theological. I use that rather religious because, again, you can't separate religious and profane, sacred and secular in the Old Testament. And the promissory one, if you want to put down a few things, it'll go here. Let's put this down. Abraham, Noah, and David. And then, of course, this is picked up again in Ezra and Nehemiah. And this is why the people in the time of Jesus could say, because they had emphasized this, we're sons of Abraham and have never been in bondage to anybody. This is why they didn't like John the Baptist or Jesus, because they were following the tradition of the prophets, saying, you've broken the covenant. It isn't even there anymore. And they said, oh no, we're sons of Abraham. We've got an everlasting covenant. The vassalage treaty is the other kind that we see most frequently. The promissory is eternal. It's called everlasting. It has no stipulations or conditions laid upon the person receiving it. The only obligations are on the person giving it. God says, I'm going to do all this. I promise to do all this. It doesn't say what Abraham's supposed to do. The other types we'll look at. Now, the type we're going to look at most is this today. In archaeological discovery, we do have some which are parallel. In other words, I said Egypt and Babylon, or Egypt and the Hittites. When they were both great powers, it would be as Russia and the United States make a treaty. This would be a parity treaty, if properly done, because they're equally great world powers. But in the Bible, none of the theological language uses that. We never take Israel as equal to God, the Creator, or God who delivered them out of the Exodus. They're never two equals. They're always number two in this point. Now, it's at this point that you get into this little book by Dr. Mendenhall. He has discovered that in Mari in the second millennium BC, there were Amorite covenants. That among the Hittites, also in the second millennium BC, but I'm going to put some specific dates down because they come into his argument a little bit, there were treaties of this type. These are all this type we're talking about. And then the Assyrian documents of the 7th century BC have vassalage treaties. In fact, the major way the Hittites kept an empire was the same way the British kept an empire. We called it colonialism, they called it vassalage. They made treaties of vassalage with this little tribe that they conquered and said, we'll protect you as long as you send us the money, as long as you obey our rules, as long as you do what we want you to do. And so the Hittite Empire, very interesting date. 1400 to 1200 B.C. Mendenhall makes a strong case, although I don't follow him completely, neither do many others, that this therefore proves that the Mosaic Covenant comes from this date. You see, this is the Moses Covenant date, and also the Moses-type covenant, Mount Sinai and Exodus, the great God and the little people whom he saves. So he makes a covenant after the battle has been won over the Egyptians, and so they exchange vassalage with Pharaoh for vassalage with Yahweh. Just as in the Exodus, if it's properly understood, in the exile, if it's properly understood, they exchange vassalage with Babylon for vassalage with Yahweh. They've escaped that king and they've come back. Or in this period, this is the period of Jeremiah and Josiah and what they call the Deuteronomic Reform, and Josiah became independent of Assyria, and so he went back to this vassalage covenant in 2 Kings 24. On this period, he said, all right, we've overthrown the Assyrians. They're no longer our lords. They're no longer the sovereign. We're no longer Assyrian vassals. We'll stop sending tribute. We'll stop obeying their rules. We'll stop sacrificing to their gods. And we've got this new Lord, Yahweh. Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy, becomes the covenant code. Now, there are 7 or 8 parts discernible, and we'll go through these right now. I put them over there because it saves my time in going through this with you. Of these 8 parts, they don't always occur exactly in this order, but these are the major parts. There are some little arguments that scholars always have as to whether the depositing and the public reading isn't the last of the stipulations. In other words, you must deposit this in the shrine, you must read it every year or every 7 years. Maybe that's the last of the stipulations, but I put it as a separate item because it fits into our biblical picture a lot better. The curses and the blessings are significant. We'll get them especially when we get to the prophets, the trial of the covenant. Now let's just look at this for example. The preamble frequently uses this. These are the words of. This is the way the Ten Commandments begin, you know. Ten Commandments aren't called the Ten Commandments. They're called the words of the Lord. These are the words of Messias, the king of the Hittites. Two, and then they name this, that, or the other vassal. The words of. Frequently this identifies the sovereign. It identifies where he came from. It perhaps gives his geography and maybe his genealogy. Messiah's son of Hattusilus. These are 2 Hittite names. But this is what we mean. I guess I ought to put the E on there, shouldn't I? So that we have everything covered. Now, frequently in this, they call him the great king. The great king. This is a phrase that's used in the Psalms and the prophets quite frequently. They use the same phrase for Yahweh, the great king. So, I am the Lord your God. Or these are the words, or hear the word of the Lord. The parallel of the preamble is quite clear. The word of the Lord. We'll go back to these many times as we go through the next 4 days, but today we're just going to take a quick summary. Now, a historical prologue can be long or short. It usually describes the background. It describes previous treaties, previous victories. It is maybe even talks about previous rebellions in which the people have had to be pacified by sending the army in. Usually it's in the I now form. I did this and you did this. And sometimes, as I say, notes this kind of thing, such as rebellion. It lists the acts of the great king, the sovereign who is making the treaty with the vassal, on which the vassal's obligations are to be established. This is the background for that. In other words, without the historical prologue, he wouldn't have any right. So, I am the king of the Hittites who conquered the Egyptians, or something of the sort. Therefore, you shall have no other gods before me. So, I am the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the house of bondage, out of the land of Egypt. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Follow how this logic fits into these things. The historical prologue is the basis for obligation. Because of the deeds which the great king did, or the deeds which God did, if you want to get it back into the religious terminology, it's quite clear. Exodus 20 verse 1 is such a one. Deuteronomy 5 verses 4 and 5. Joshua 24 verses 3 to 13. We'll deal with these a little more in detail tomorrow. Then comes the basic declaration. The basic declaration, or the summary statement, is usually a statement of loyalty. It's interesting that all 3 of the theological words that we make a lot of talk about, in fact, Professor Gabrielson in his study of 1 John with the staff Bible study is making a great deal out of the Hebrew word knows and the Greek word know. And the Hebrew word meaning something different than the Greek word does. And in these Hittite words, the word know. I know you. Which means I acknowledge you and I understand you and I accept you and receive you as part of my kingdom. Also, I love you is used. These are peculiar things, you see. Up until 1955, people used to say, and they still say it now in the civil rights movement, don't they? You can't compel a man to love. You know, love the Negro, love the Norwegian if you're German, love the German if you're Norwegian, you know, this kind of thing. You can't compel love, you can't compel love. We've said this for years. And maybe some lawyers agree with it. But in the Hittite treaties, they used the word, thou shalt love me and no one else. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Parallel what a Hittite king says to a vassal. Same type of statement, the basic declaration. It's a legal way of recognizing that you're following in the footsteps of the sovereign Lord. Now the stipulations. These can be long or short. These are the obligations, and they're always defined by the great king who brought you out of Egypt, or who conquered the Egyptians, or who did whatever was the historical basis. And he then tells you, thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do this. Now, up until 1955, there were a great many scholars who followed a fellow by the name of Albrecht Alt. And he used to say that the oldest commandments were the ones that had the thou shalt in them. And that the later commandments were like Supreme Court things, casuistry. If a man does this, or when a man does this, or if an ox gores this, or so on. But these are later. Now, Mendenhall has shown, and so have the others who've worked on the archaeology, that that can't be true anymore. That in 1400 to 1200 BC, you find both forms in the same clay tablet. Thou shalt not, and if you do this, you have them both. So they're at least, at the time of Moses, they're still contemporaneous. Now, if we could move back another 2,000 years, perhaps, and find some archaeological material, maybe all could still be proved correct, and that is, thou shalt was first, and if. Just as the Bill of Rights came before the Supreme Court statements on pornography, or the Supreme Court statements on civil rights, or the rights of criminals, and so on. The Supreme Court statements become case histories, and that's why lawyers, I shouldn't get into Dr. Rieke's field here, but this is why lawyers are always looking up stacks of books. They're looking for a precedent here and a precedent there. Did any court ever do something that might be in favor of my client? And they search up the iffies, the whens, and this so on. They don't always win their case on the basis of the Bill of Rights. They have to say, well, now the Bill of Rights were interpreted by the Washington State Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals or by the United States Supreme Court. And they said, if this and this and this happens, then you can do this. So stipulations are not to be dated on the basis of thou versus if. They're all the same. Now, some of the things standardly appear. First, you must give me military help. In other words, the vassal provides part of the army for the sovereign. This might explain why Joshua and Gideon and others, you see, fought for the Lord with Judean army help. There's also something about the treatment of refugees in almost all of these. This is why the Old Testament, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, especially has something about the stranger in your midst. Maybe he's a refugee from another tribe that has been defeated or scattered, or maybe he's even a refugee from your former enemy. But you treat him, you remember, for you too were once a sojourner and a stranger in Egypt, so you treat him well. This is the ground. Of course, obviously, if this is really a treaty of a great king with a little king, there are no other alliances, no other treaties. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. This is clear. I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. I will be jealous about my prerogatives, and I'll be zealous to protect you. This is the mutual part of a vassalage treaty. There's also that whole thing that comes in Deuteronomy 5. You shall teach these to your children. Don't let them ever forget. You know how Deuteronomy says you teach them to your children when you're lying down, when you're rising up, and so on. You will say all these things, and they'll know it. Now, as I say, number 5 over there could be considered the last of the stipulations. It includes this. That the copy of this, or at least one copy of this, will be kept in the shrine of the god. In the temple, if you want to put it that way, of the Hittite and of his vassal. It will always be kept there. Remember how they deposited the book, the law, the Ten Commandments, and the Ark of the Covenant, how the Ark of the Covenant always went to the tabernacle. When they got rid of the tabernacle, they put the Ark of the Covenant with the tables of the law in it, in the Holy of Holies, in the temple. Because that's part of the way you did a covenant in those days. It's like putting it into the sacred archives or in a safety deposit box so you'd always know where it was. And then it had to be read. Now there's debate in Israel as to whether they renewed this covenant and read it publicly every year or every 7 years. And our treaties in archaeology don't help us too much on this. Some of the treaties are read every year, annually. You read the whole blooming thing. Remember Joshua read it all to him? Josiah read it all to him? Ezra read it all to him? Nehemiah read it all to them? And probably in between it was occasionally read. So this is part of the rule. In addition to this, they did something else that sets new light on some certain things of the Old Testament we didn't always know about. And that is that in addition to having it hidden in the shrine, after all nobody could look at it, there it's at the high priest. And here you only hear it once every year or once every 7 years. What about the interval? They carved it on stones. And they'd set it up on a monument somewhere nearby. At a crossroad especially, so that everybody who went into town with these crop or with these milk or with these goat skins, he would get a chance to read it. Now we knew they did this in the Old Testament. There are two passages where this is done. One is in Hezekiah. Hezekiah gets cured of a disease after he repents, and he puts a stelae up, a monument, which records the new covenant and the grace and his thanks to God, because Isaiah and God have healed Hezekiah. And this is erected. But at Shechem and at Gilgal, they erected some stones, and we call them memorial stones in our normal testament. Actually, at Gilgal and at Shechem, they weren't memorial stones. They were covenant stones in which the words of the covenant had been written so that everybody who came and could see them could say, this is the place where it was done, where this actually took place, and this is what we must do. The tables of testimony. Now, we're going to look up a few passages here if we have time, but I wanted to go through this. Then come the list of witnesses. Now, this is true even if you're making the last will and testament. Many times, some people decide they're going to leave some money to St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Toledo, and they don't get a lawyer, and they write out something interesting, and they don't get any witness. Now, it's a perfectly nice-looking document. They've even maybe typed it up, or even they've written it in their nice Spencerian handwriting, and they signed it, and they dated it, but we don't get any money. Because they didn't have any witnesses, that's the major reason. So even here, now the Hittites and their vassals, you know who the witnesses were? Well, there wasn't anybody bigger on earth than the king, so who could witness it? Had to be the gods. The gods of the Hittites and the gods of the vassals were called to witness this. Sometimes they had as many as 250 guys called on as witnesses. What does this mean? This means that if the vassal breaks the covenant, the gods are going to help this king to keep, get the punishment done. Now, by the time the Bible came around, or at least the prophets in the Bible, they didn't particularly believe in all these other gods. There was only one God. The Hittites believed that the earth and the mountains and the seas and the rivers and all these natural phenomena were divine spirits and gods. They're all demythologized in the Psalms and in the prophets. But when you get over here at number 4, you remember how many of them start out chapters in the Isaiah? Hear, O earth, and give ear, O mountains. It's a remembrance of number 6 over here. Even though they don't think that those mountains are gods anymore, they still use the form of the literature. They're still letting you hear about it. Or then when you get to Joshua, where they don't want to call on anything, he says, we are witnesses. Or you are witnesses. In other words, you are witnesses against yourselves. We don't call in outside witnesses, but there's always a witness involved. We'll go now to the curses and the blessings. Some of these items might occasionally be missing in our archaeological program. There may be an occasionally where this stipulation of deposit public reading might be missing. The summary statement might merge from the historical prologue to the first of the obligations, and so you might miss this. But curses are never missed. They're in every one of the so far discovered archaeological treaties of the 14th and 15th century BC, as well as the 7th century BC. They're always there. And when we come down to the prophet at the trial of the covenant breakers, you'll see that although some of the curses we find in Amos and in Deuteronomy sound pretty far out, pretty mean, they're just part and parcel of the whole Near Eastern way of cursing. And we can, one of my friends, Delbert Hillier, wrote his PhD thesis on treaty curses and the Old Testament prophets, in which he paralleled all these Hittite and Assyrian curses with Amos and Isaiah and Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, and practically parallel. Nothing new under the sun, in a way. Now, does that mean that you shouldn't believe the Bible? No. It means that the Bible was using language the people already knew, and they were making it very strong. So the curses and the blessings. How do these happen? This is an important thing because it goes into the theology that I was talking about last week, and since all of you are practically new, this will not be repeating. This word up here, the word the great sovereign, has power within itself because he is so great. That combined with the witness of the gods or the witness of the people, this brings about the curses or the blessings. You don't need anything else. It just happens that way. So, for example, in the Old Testament, my word shall not return unto me void. It can't. Who gave it? God, the most powerful speaker of all, gave it. And the word contained within itself the power to fulfill itself. So if the covenant includes people calling on the gods to curse me, if it's been proclaimed by a great king, it has the germ of fulfilling itself already. It isn't a later addition, you see. The curse isn't something that happens because this is a new way of looking at things. No, this happens because it was implicit from the very beginning in what you took on yourself. The curses are there. They may be long and they may be varied. I've already mentioned Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, first chapters of Amos, the woes against the foreign nations. Now this is again something interesting for the last 10 years of Old Testament study. Just as we used to think that thou shalt not, and if a man, had two different dates of origin, so many people used to think that woe unto you, or damned be you, or cursed be you, was earlier than blessing in the Old Testament prophets. And so frequently you see in commentaries that the woe statements were original, and the others were editorial emendations put later. Now, this could still be true, but you can't prove it now because in these they have both. Simultaneous as early as 1400. So the two things go hand in hand. In other words, if a man does good, he gets protection from the great sovereign. If he does evil, he gets cursed. Two go hand in hand. So that we don't have to say that the fourth commandment is the only one with a promise. You know, thou shalt love your father and your mother, honor your father and your mother, so that thy days may be long upon the earth. Now that's the only one where the blessing is spelled out. But if you understand this treaty system, thou shalt have no other gods before me, also has a blessing implicit. I'll treat you as my only son. I'll be good to you, and I'll bless and protect you all the way along. Now, the last item is the ceremonial conclusion. We don't always have this in present-day treaties, although in a historical study of it we would, but these are actually in it. The ceremony often includes a meal in which they break bread together. It often includes a sacrifice, and the word cut a sacrifice that I had over here probably has a symbolism in it. In the Hebrew, they occasionally cut the sacrifice, and they took the blood of the one part of it and threw it on the altar, and the blood of the other and threw it on the people. And this made them one, you see, because they had the same blood. When I was a little boy, some of the Indian tribes used to come through the East, and they'd have adoption ceremonies. So they adopted me once in an Indian tribe, and they pricked my vein, and then they pricked the chief's vein, and then we'd cross veins, and we'd be blood brothers. Now, I mean, it's only a symbolism, so I get to be tall white grass, according to my Indian name. Because I got a new name. We'll get into that too when we get to the king as Yahweh's vessel, because when you get this new covenant, you also get a new name. And the Indians still carry it on. But that was the one way in which you share. You see, you share the same blood. But sometimes you cut the covenant, and then you parade through it like a procession. And you've been united. And then you take an oath. And here you don't understand the Old Testament unless you are a Jew with gestures. Now, you can take it occurs both ways. Every now and then you read in the Bible, the Lord do this and more so to me if I don't obey or so-and-so, or if I break my covenant. Now, it could be, here's this poor little pig. No, it wouldn't have been a pig, but it would have been a lamb. Here's this poor little lamb who's been cut in half. And the guy swears on a stack of Bibles. Weren't any Bibles in those days either. But on a stack of Bibles, the Lord do this to me, and worse, if I'm not loyal to my covenant. In other words, the Lord split me apart. This is a pretty good oath, you know. The other way, sometimes if it isn't involved in a covenant, if it's just a statement of a couple of friends, it probably has to be done this way. The Lord do to me, and more so. I mean, it probably, that's what you should do. You have to put in the gesture. Lord, do this and more so. He either slits my throat and disembowels me, or he says, may I be like the slain lamb if I don't remain loyal to my covenant. They also use words that we think are wonderfully theological words. One of the Assyrians down here said, now you must swear your loyalty to me with your whole heart and not with your lips only. Heard that in the prophets occasionally, haven't you? This people draws nigh to me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And people weren't very different, you see, even though they weren't Hebrews. They weren't very different. And this guy knew that there were a lot of people who'd swear, they'd cuss, and they'd curse, and they'd take oaths, and they'd handshakes, and then they'd double-cross quickly, because it was just lip service. And so the Hittite and the Assyrian kings sometimes even said, now you swear with your whole heart, don't just swear with your lips. Sometimes they shook hands. You maybe didn't realize that they shook hands. Actually, they really didn't shake hands. They probably had some kind of a statement about castration, and they probably shook testicles. This is probably what was involved, and that too, you see, is pretty much, may the Lord castrate me if I'm not loyal to you. Usually it's said handshake in the Bible, but it probably doesn't mean that. It probably means testicles. Now, this is the form. Now, just in the few minutes we have remaining, let's open our Bibles. If some of you brought your Bibles, let's just look at a few. Let's look at the preamble in Exodus 20. And God spoke all these words. Then, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You see the historical prologue. I am the Lord your God. That's all. You don't have any definition. The word Lord is capital letters in your Bible, and that stands for the proper name, Yahweh, that I've used over here in my title. Yahweh is the proper name of God in the Old Testament. And so, when you see L-O-R-D with four capital letters, it's like saying, I am Marcellus, the great king of the Hittites. So, I am Yahweh, the Lord of the Israelites. You see the parallel? Now, what does Marcellus do? He had conquered some enemies and so on. So what did Yahweh do? I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Now, the summary statement could be the first commandment. And then the stipulations begin with verse 4, or you could say they've omitted the summary statement. I personally like to say verse 3 is the summary statement. You shall have no other gods before me. And then the rest of it are the rules to prove it. In other words, what's it mean not to have any other gods, all right? Don't make graven images. Don't take my name and my purpose. Don't cry for military help when you don't need it. That's actually what the covenant guy would be saying. He said, don't ask for the Hittite army to come down and protect you from the Canaanites if you can lick them by yourself. I mean, why take the name of the Lord your God in vain? Why call wolf if you don't need an army to save your sheep? So don't take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The name means purpose. It means don't call on his might and power and so on. And then remember his day, honor your folks, and all the rest of them. Now, let's look at that part of it. Now let's turn to Psalm 47, just to get some of these phrases again. There are many of these psalms. We could spend a whole week on just the psalms in relationship to the covenant, but we won't do it. Psalm 47. Is a psalm which has to do with making a covenant with the Lord. Shout to God with loud songs of joy, for the Lord, that's that capital word again, the Most High is terrible, a great king. That's the Hittite phrase. Melech Rab is the Hebrew, and Melech Gadol is the equivalent of it. Great king. And what's he done? He subdued peoples under us, he subdued nations under our feet, and then he chose us. He made us. Then, of course, it comes again, verse 7, God is the king of all the earth. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his throne. And verse 10, under the newest translation of with Ugaritic, the word shield should never be translated shield anymore. Although it makes sense, it's a good symbolic way. The shields of the Lord belong, shields of the earth belong to God. Dahud in the Anchor Bible, who is probably the world's greatest Ugaritic scholar, has discovered that the word shield in Hebrew doesn't really mean shield, it means sovereignty. For all the sovereignty of the earth belongs to God. And this, of course, parallels. He is highly exalted. Shield is good symbolism. Now, we won't take any more time on that one. Let's look at Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5, you remember, has the Ten Commandments in it. It again has the introduction, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances which I speak in your hearing this day. You shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us who are here. And then they describe the scene. And then comes the repetition of the Ten Commandments. Now, if you go to the end of this, you will note that there are some other things that are continued, some more statutes. But look at verse 22. And he wrote them upon two tables of stone and gave them to me. And then later on, he gives a commandment that you should deposit these commandments. It follows the same thing. Now turn to Joshua 24. We'll spend a lot of time on Joshua 24 tomorrow, but just briefly we'll look at it here at the moment. Joshua 24, verses 2. Now in this, you probably have a sermonic development of the historical prologue. He's got a lot more here. Verses 2 through 13 are all the historical prologue. Or prelude, however you want to say it. It talks about Abraham and Nahor. It talks about Esau and Jacob. It talks about the Exodus. It even talks about the conquest of Canaan and defeating the Moabites. And I gave you a land. And now look at verse 14. Now therefore, you see, the basis for the stipulations and the whole covenant is because I've done all this. I spent 11 verses telling you what I've done. Now I'm going to give you 24 chapters or so telling what you better do. So the summary statement is revere the Lord, fear the Lord, and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. And then you get the same thing as if it were, thou shalt have no other gods before me. It says, put away the gods which your fathers served. It's the same thing. And you could go on. Now, we'll come back to this, the stipulations are all there. Now let's turn to Deuteronomy 31. To talk about the deposit. Deuteronomy 31, verses 10 and following. Note this reading. Moses commanded them at the end of every 7 years, at the set time of the year of the release, at the Feast of the Booths, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place which he will choose, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. And then it tells you a little bit more. You can find this also in 2 Kings 22. Let's do it again. Just turn to 2 Kings 22. You remember, Josiah had found a book. And apparently Josiah had been living as if he had a promissory covenant, the Davidic covenant, and he didn't have to keep any obligations. Then they discovered a book which may have been the book of Deuteronomy. And he suddenly discovered that he wasn't just under number three, a promissory eternal covenant, he also had a vassal covenant. And so he has to do this. 2 Kings 22, verse 8 says, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. And then the king commanded that it be done, and they then read it all the way through. You can see the rest of it. This whole story follows it as he commanded them to read it. They found this book of the law, and now they go ahead and read it to all the people. Now, the last thing, I guess we might look up, just one more thing. One of the meals or sacrificial things we could talk about is Exodus 24. We'll do more detail of this tomorrow. Exodus 24, verse 12. Here Moses goes up, you see, after the people have had, look at verse 11. He did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. And then the Lord said, come on up to me at the mountain and wait there, and I will give you a table of stone with the law and the commandments which I have written. And Moses rose up and went into the mountain. And he tarried there, and then Moses stayed for so long. Well, let's close off with just a couple of summary statements then. Ike Roth and Mendenhall insist that the Hittite date of some of these treaties helps us to affirm a Mosaic date and origin to much of the covenant concept of Old Testament. There are others who are not quite as positive, including myself. McCarthy, however, a Catholic scholar who is now teaching in the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome, sums it up rather well, saying this: the evidence that Israel uses the treaty in some of its religious literature and uses it to describe its special relationship with Yahweh is irrefragable. There is not another literary form from among those of the ancient Near East which is more certainly evident in the Old Testament. Now that's the clue for the rest of the 4 days that we're going to work on. In other words, there is no other literary form in archaeological evidence that is repeated so exactly and used so frequently as the treaty form, especially the vassalage, number two, treaty form, in ancient Israel. Are there some questions before we break off? Tomorrow and the next day will be Bible only. We'll just refer to this. I'm going to try to leave up that one list over there so you have it. You won't have to write it up each time.
Reference to Hezekiah.
The Hezekiah passage is the one that you find in the story of Isaiah. Let me see, that's 2 Kings. I'll have to look it up and find it for you. See, it's around 37 or thereabouts.
Is that a thank offering?
Yes, right. It was setting up after he became well. Yeah, right. Well, it's around the middle of 1st Isaiah. Any other questions? All right, I guess we'll take a 5-minute break, Dr. Rieke. Is that
whatever's
good enough? I have about 22 after. We start at 5:30. Maybe that'll be just about right. Okay, if any of you are really interested, some of the laymen probably aren't, but if some of you are interested in following this up, I do have a bibliography that some of you might want to read. Some of the pastors or some of the laymen who really like their Bible study might enjoy it. Thank you. We can stretch a little bit.